These are the Target Files. Journey back with us between the 1970s and 1990s on a TARDIS nostalgia trip as we look back at the novelizations and audiobook releases of classic Doctor Who stories. Accessing Gallifreyan Archives. Subject, Time Lord, known as the Doctor. Fourth Incarnation. Subcategory. The Sontaran Experiment. Authors, Bob Baker and Dave Martin.
Landing on Earth, now a barren, desolate planet, Sarah, Harry and the Fourth Doctor are unaware of large watching robot. The robot is the work of Styr, a Sontaran warrior, who uses all humans landing here as his experimental programs. Hello there, this is the Target Files, and this week we are discussing the Sontaran Experiment, a book written by Ian Marta and the audiobook read by John Coleshaw. So, Mike, what did you think of the book?
Written for TV by the Bristol Boys, Bob Baker and Dave Martin. Seen as a filler episode, really. I mean, it's only two episodes in the old 25-minute format, but certainly a book compared to the TV show that Ian Marta really manages to flesh out. And I'm finding, I think we spoke about the Ark in Space amongst ourselves elsewhere last year, Al. I really am into the writing of Ian Marta in these Target book pubs. Scope, he adds a heck of a lot of detail. Well, that's my general thoughts overall.
Well, yeah, I would agree with most of that because it, as you know, it's a two parts. So you had to squeeze a lot into those two parts in the TV thing, where the book is really nicely fleshed out. It's got some really great descriptions of the Sontarans, the ship, the way the Earth's been sort of turned into a scorched landscape, which I think in the TV program, they use Dartmoor for that sort of landscape.
They use Dartmoor. The TV version works brilliantly. I mean, the outdoor location filming is very good, with lots of little chasms and things, which sort of look more like ditches, which they do on the British landscape, I suppose, don't they? That was the restrictions of it.
I think it does work, though, both of them. I think the book is better because of the sort of spread out of Ian Marta's writing. His writing is so detailed. I really enjoy his writing.
I'm in two minds about the location. I think as you read the book, you can almost picture it actually being underground, can't you? But whether it's on the TV version, it's actually above ground.
I think the book works better because you sort of see the sort of way these people are trying to find them. So they would go into the caves. They would go closer to the Earth's crust to get some warmth, maybe. And it just doesn't... It looks like they're just, you know, out in the open in the TV version.
Yes, I mean, it does work to some extent in that way. But there's also a running joke, isn't there, amongst the Doctor and Harry, in that the TARDIS, once again, is aiming for Piccadilly Circus. That's related to later on in the story, where Tom's Doctor is wondering whereabouts they are in London, you know, in the sewage system. This used to be a sewer. That I won't spoil anything, but that turns into quite an important part of the plot.
Yeah, it does. Do you think that's the Bristol Boys trying to homage back to things like the Web of Fear, tunnels and all that, and that's what they... I do think with this book, there is a lot of references to other things.
Apparently, Ian Marta, the history of this book, was nobody else wanting to novelise it.
Oh, really?
Being the sort of go-forward two guy that we know from stories about him, that he offered to do it. So he obviously knew the story well, having appeared as Harry. But yes, he starts it off. He manages to have a bit of continuity with his Ark in Space novelisation. In the television version, the Time Lords have control of the TARDIS after the genesis of the Daleks. And Dr. Harry and Sarah are using the time ring to move about. But they do actually have the TARDIS at the beginning of this book, and then it's spirited away somewhere via a transmat beam. You know, he's added that little detail to it, which explains the continuity of the story on TV and in the books. A nice little clever touch he brings in there.
Yeah, definitely. I think both those sort of elements work. There's lots of little clever touches like that through the book. So the book can sort of stand on its own and also be connected to the TV world, so I think.
Yeah, and what do you think of the characters, Al? You have the three astronauts who have become stranded on Earth. I'll just get their names. Roth and Vural are the two sort of main ones.
There's sort of gung-ho stereotypes. I thought a little bit. Don't like science and don't understand what, you know, the bit at the end where they think, you know, the doctor's teleport and they think it's magic. They're a little bit stereotyped. I did enjoy them. They've got good bits, you know, what happened with them.
Very alpha male, aren't they? And we'll talk about the audiobook in a little while, but portrayed on television and by John Coshall in the audio reading as a South African, a very sort of macho voice.
Oh yeah, most definitely. John Coleshill definitely gets this gung-ho macho, definitely. We'll discuss that with the audiobook because he does a great reading of them.
Yes, no nonsense to the point.
They do stand out a little bit as maybe two-dimensional, I think, because of what we discussed later, the way John Coles does, and they are actually quite fun.
To move on to Ian Martyr's descriptions again, some of them are so vivid, so visceral, aren't all with the Ark in space. You know, something that I think Robert Holmes, possibly himself, as an older man, but he only did the one novelization of the two Doctors. And he had a real viscerality about his writing in that you feel the sensations of character, feel the breath, you feel what they feel when they're in a certain situation. He makes it so...
I love all that, you know, Harry is trying to get through the tunnels and get stuck, and you feel like you're there with him, the way it's really well written.
Yes,
I thought that was one of the good bits. And I also thought the way, you know, the song Taran spits out all that gunk and how that's really nastily written, I thought.
Very sensory, isn't it? Sensory written, very sort of visceral, sort of horrific in certain instances.
Oh, most definitely. We don't spoil the good bits. Well, near the ending where something happens to the song Taran when he's on fire and he's sort of, you do feel slightly sorry for him.
Yeah, it's amazing that's characteristic can make you feel that sort of...
You're not meant to like him at all. I actually sort of came round to feeling a bit sorry where he goes at the end.
Not so much a spoiler. This is mentioned on a documentary called On Target, which was released on the Revisitations 2 box set as part of its re-release of Carnival of Monsters, the John Pertwee story, back in 2011. Sarah Jane actress Liz Sladen reminiscing on Ian Martyr, and she actually reads out a passage from this book when Ian Martyr describes the arrival, the cliffhanger to episode one, of General Steyr the Sontaran. I'll read these two lines. Steyr had two mean eyes which burned like two hot red coals amid the gnarled tortoise-like features. And there is so much detail there, isn't there, Al? It really paints that big picture for you.
Completely, just in a couple of lines, you get a complete outlook of how he's a warrior, he's deadly, you know, just from the eyes, you know, you don't need to know about the rest of him.
And then he talks about the vapour of the nostrils, you know, as he approaches Sarah Jane and he's got these pronged hands sticking out. And, you know, and then it's sort of compared to the TV version, and he more or less just walks over to her. Okay, he's a Sontaran, he walks over to her in the TV version. But, you know, painting that picture of monster is so vivid.
Two different things, you know. Well, the book gives you the menace where the actor was probably told that, and just the way they do it doesn't do it, I think.
Novel-wise, this is anything but a filler, isn't it? Pretty well-paced. Pretty well considered, very, very visceral, horror-like story.
I think it's really well paced. Well, did you find the chapters a wee bit long in the book?
One or two, I think. The opening ones, you know, if you compare it to the audiobook, there's a few 20-minute chapters, isn't there? And it sort of extends over to 28, 29 minutes as it goes on. And it does sort of, as we said with The Curse of Fenric last time out, it does sort of cut between the various characters very sort of sharply at times.
Yeah, but I think it works again because you're so caught up with what's going on with Harry and Sarah, and I think it really doesn't matter, to be honest.
Just to talk about a few influences in this book, descriptive strength of Ian Martyr's is in describing the Sontaran as a golem-like character. And you get a whole passage there, which sort of alludes to the orcs in Lord of the Rings.
I think it's more in The Hobbit than Lord of the Rings. That whole bit with the Misty Mountain, the underground and the trolls, and it felt more like that to me.
Yeah, because he describes them as sort of formed, enhanced humans, doesn't he? And that really puts you in the mind of either the trolls or the orcs in the later Tolkien works of Lord of the Rings.
I just think his whole description of characters and aliens is really well done in this book.
There are quite a few deviations in this book from the televised story. This information has come to us from TARDISwikia.com. It's a great site, folks. Have a read of it. Has a good page and pictures of the covers of all the Target novelizations.
Yeah, it's a very good site.
A few of these differences I have mentioned already, including the TARDIS going missing, Dr. Sarah and Harry using the time ring within the TV show, following on from continuity, as we said before, following the Ark in Space novel where the TARDIS is still there. They arrive in the TARDIS, but the way the Sontarans have set up this experiment, it's actually transmitted away at the time, isn't it? Quite cleverly done by Ian Marta there.
Very cleverly done.
Yeah, the nervous space beacon from Ark in Space is consistently referred to by the Doctor and the other characters as Terra Nova.
Well, I wonder if I read that, if that was the same thing.
Yeah, because they mention Nerva first of all, don't they? And then
yeah,
it's seen as a myth at that time, isn't it? Someone that's gone missing.
That all gets explained in the first ever BigFinish.com Tom Baker story.
Ah, brilliant. And what's that one called out? So our listeners can have a...
It's... Oh, are you going to ask that? I think it's Return to Nerva. We'll just double check that.
Oh, about that. So that's out at BigFinish.com.
Indeedy.
One of the major differences, it's very visceral nature again, is after falling down a hole, the Doctor has this excellent dream that's described so well about rats chewing their way into the TARDIS and a giant cat sitting on his chest after it scared the rats away. What did you make of that part, Al?
That was just very weird and very fun, but it's not in the TV thing, is it?
Yeah, it's something that sort of sounds quite visceral and horrific, but in the same way, there's a great deal of humour about it, isn't it? Particularly when the cat appears.
It's just that, I don't know if it's just me, it's just the idea of Tom Baker sitting there with a large cat on him, you know, where they're going for sort of blowout ideas.
A few other differences. The Sontaran robot is called a scavenger, and it's described as hovering and octopus-like. Not really what we see in the TV version. It sort of looks like one of those Mars space probes, doesn't it?
It doesn't look as good as the description.
The long spidery legs. Quite good for the time, I think.
It's not bad for the time period. I think the description's better in the book.
Yeah, it puts a better idea in your mind.
Definitely, definitely.
Styer's energy weapon, General Styer, the Sontaran, his energy weapon is built into his armour. It's described as concealed by the armour.
Bit where the Doctor challenges him, he goes straight for that. And I wonder, is that right? Because I remember it always being in the other bit.
Yes, and also the Sontaran ship is much larger than the one seen in the TV version.
Was the TV version a tiny model?
Yes, and a description of its interior as multi-chambered. It's also apparently controlled by smaller versions of the scavenger robot. What do you make of the Sontaran ship design, Al? I've always sort of liked them. I think they brought them back in the new series in the Sontaran stratagem and the Sarah Jane episode with the Sontarans. I've always sort of liked circular, rugged sort of design on the outside, isn't it? I've always liked that design.
I really like it. I've always liked it. I think it's how a spaceship should look, because it would be bad going like through asteroid fields and orbits of different space, so I don't think they should look sort of pristine.
Also, the Doctor falls down the crevice when the scavenger lassoes Sarah and Roth while they are lowering him with his scarf. There are a heck of a lot of differences from this wiki page, Al, apparently.
I know, it's definitely looking like they just gave Ian Marta the sort of basics and he went off and did a much better job.
Yeah, also with the fact that he knew it was only two parts long, so he knew he had to flesh it up, but he has really gone for it here by the look of it.
No, most definitely, because I just think the book is 100 times better than the two episodes.
Also, Styer's experiment on Sarah is more elaborate. She hallucinates drowning, being burned alive in a desert, and attacked by a horde of ants. Yeah, that's really quite horrific, really, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really horrific. And I take it, because they would never got that past Mary Whitehouse, that they didn't actually show you all that.
The book was actually published in 1978, so that's a good 4 years after it was broadcast, so perhaps that wasn't in the... initial script at all, but there again we go. Ian Marta has really expanded on it there.
What about the bit where Sarah sort of gets the sort of feral vampire teeth and goes for Harry? Is that in the TV? No, I don't think it's either. That's what I was wondering. I thought it was very scary. Sort of tries to go for it when she's sort of being experimented on and doesn't have a clue what she's doing by the end.
I've just seen the paragraph here, Al. After she's had the dream about being burned alive in the desert, attacked by a horde of ants, she is imprisoned in a cave, rather than being tied to a rock. When Harry enters the cave, he is affected too, imagining himself being attacked by a demonic Sarah. And that means the experiment has already begun, of course.
Do you really find out why the Sontarans are experimenting? That's the other thing I want. There's some form of reason, but when I read it, I couldn't see the actual...
That is actually interesting you say that, Al. That is another difference, because they are trying to evaluate what sort of threat humans are before they invade. In the novelisation, the Doctor speculates the Sontarans are trying to occupy Earth for its Terulian deposits, formed by the solar flares, and later discovers it's part of an alliance with another cloned race, the Hyperioi.
That's why. I just feel that wasn't greatly explained in the book.
I mean, to some extent, the Sontarans in this Like I've seen, they're a little bit dense, aren't they, in terms of the experiments they do on the various astronauts.
Yeah, not as the most brightest of intelligence.
But do you feel so the human astronauts are sort of portrayed in that more sort of thuggish manner to elevate the Sun Tower's intelligence?
Maybe a little bit, because, you know, they probably would be sort of put off if they thought to be, you know, it's a warrior race. They would probably think, hey, why are people treating us stupid? So probably maybe that's why they're... The humans don't do that to them.
What a nice swift ending, really, hasn't it, to the novel? I mean, we'll...
I do like... It's a sort of interesting ending. I do like it.
Yeah, no spoilers there, folks. Moving on to the cover. The book was published by Target Books, W.H. Allen, on the 7th of December, 1978. A nice sort of bluey cover written by Roy Knight. Doctor Who Tom Baker symbol. Blue lettering on a white background banner on the word Doctor on the top. Tom's... Doctor standing in front of an enlarged picture, a close-up picture of the Sun Tower with a helmet on. It sort of tells you what's going on, I think.
Oh, definitely, definitely. That definitely tells you. Again, he seems to get, I don't know if he had involvement here, Martel. He seems to get good covers what tell you exactly what's going to happen, I think.
Yeah, so the prominent yellow on the Ark in Space.
Yeah, the nice colour, you know, sort of colour palette would stand out and you would notice. Again, like as you said, with the yellow on the Ark in Space and now a really nice shade of blue. It would sort of stick out. And I think he must have had some, I think he must have had something to do with cover design as well, Ian Mark, because they're always good covers.
Prominent. It's got sort of the grey skies in the background, which they had in Dartmoor when they filmed in September, surprisingly enough, in the UK.
He's got even more in Devon and Dartmoor even in September. I'm not surprised.
Tom is carrying something in his right hand. I'm trying to work out what.
Is it a yo? Well, he had a lot of yo-yos, didn't he? So maybe, it might be the metal.
Ah, it could be the metal stick, that's right. His other hand clamped around one end of his scarf, looking quite prominent. Yeah, I mean, I think it would pique my interest as a youngster.
I think so as well. Again, it sounds like a good cover, what it says. It's got, well, you'll probably repeat by the Sontaran, you know, the second time they've ever been in something. And Tom on the cover, I think it sounds a good sort of pick-up cover, basically.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hi there, welcome to the Who's News. First thing need to mention, it is breaking apparently this week, is that we have another part of the new Chris Chibnall lineup for season 11, and this will be Matt Strevens. He's done such things as Cucumber and Misfits and lots of good Channel 4 drama, so I think it will be in a safe pair of hands. Another bit of upcoming news for season 10 of Doctor Who, which is filming at the moment, is that there's going to be a cameo from Ralph Little. He's done such things as The Royal Family and also My Life in the Sioux, which is very good fun. Also coming out next month is the audio version of Ian Stewart Black's book, The Macro Terror, read with great interest by Annika Wills. Hopefully it will have a fantastic soundscape like all these new releases seem to have. Also being announced with a 2017 release date is the first Dr. William Hartnell story, Planet of the Giant. No reader has been announced yet for that, but I would expect and we can hope that it's William Russell, who always does great readings of the Hartnell era. And from BigFinish.com this week, we have Life of Crime, which is Sylvester McCoy being brilliant with Mel and Ace. For some reason, connected to Dragonfire, he's being talked into doing a bank robbery. Also released this week is The Pursuit of History, starring Tom Baker, Lara Ward as Romana, and David Warner as Cuthbert. Also out this week, if you're into Countermeasures, which is the spin-off from Doctor Who, there is a new box set from Big Finish. It's called Who Killed Toby Kinsella, and it's connected, if you listen to it, to the last box set. But I think you can still listen to it as a standalone.
Moving on to the audiobook read by John Culshaw, released at the beginning of this month as we record, July 2016. Your initial thoughts, Al, we listened to John perform The Ark in Space last year. Do you think he's improved his reading of this?
I think so. I think he's got Sarah's voice a little bit better. He's definitely got Harry's voice better. Well, I think he's, you know, his Tom Baker impression is bang on. It's always been brilliant. But I think there was bits when I can never remember Tom being as angry as him in the Sontar Expert. He did go a little bit over the top with Tom's anger, I think, sometimes in this.
I only had an issue with the Ark in Space because I was having trouble distancing myself from his comedic impression of Tom Baker at the time. But I thought he was a little bit more measured, not so much angry, but a little bit more measured than he was in the Ark in Space. A little bit less, maybe over the top, you know, really sort of going for it with Tom like that. I thought he'd taken the tone down a little. He was a little bit more measured in this book, and I think it suited it.
Well, I think there's a reason for that. And I think the reason that is he's actually been working with Tom in the last couple of months.
Aha! Excellent point, Al. Very good point.
He's been working with, we don't know what, because Big Finish are keeping it under wraps. Well, on the podcast, not this week, 2 weeks ago, there was an interview with John Coleshaw.
Oh, excellent. So look out for that.
He's working in the studio with Tom on a Fourth Doctor thing.
Oh, look out for that, folks. That should be very, very interesting.
And that's why I think he's actually... Because he doesn't seem to do the Tom Baker impression any longer on Dead Ringers.
No, that's true. I mean, it's still going as a radio show, isn't it?
Dead Ringers? Still going as a radio show. Yeah. The only thing he does is the opening and the ending as Tom Baker. So they haven't had a parody for quite a while now, I don't think.
I thought, like
you were going to say, the other people had very sort of full-on angry voices. We're here to, you know, look after the planet. The other guys did, the spacemen did.
I think his South African voices for the astronauts and the Sontaran were absolutely spot on. I thought they really reminded me and took me into the TV show again.
Oh, well, most definitely. It was just so bang on with how the voices should be from the TV program. He's obviously watched it before he did this, I think.
Yeah, it is. It's Harry Sullivan is very good as well, I think. And as you said, you think his Sarah Jane has improved, Al?
Yeah, I'd say a little bit. I think he's got it more how she would have been. It's absolutely fantastic, the sound effects and all the background bits on this one. It is one of the better ones again.
We might move towards our overall thoughts on this book. And
Definitely. So what was yours?
Just as I mentioned at the beginning, I think a good going romp, a good little space adventure, possibly, just to go back and mention influences, a bit of a Planet of the Apes vibe about it with the astronauts.
Yeah, most definitely. I didn't think about that. So yeah, I thought definitely that sort of stuck on a planet, what happens next sort of thing.
Oh, even modern films like The Martian we've had lately, haven't we? And Colony and Cats, Gravity.
Yeah, definitely.
Very 70s and 60s, some of those films, very memorable, weren't they? But anyway, back to the book. Yeah, very well written. I find myself a huge fan of Ian Marta's writing. Sadly passed away 30 years ago this year, had a form of diabetes and died from complications to do with that in autumn 1986. He ended up doing 9 Target novels. I think we've covered 2 here and elsewhere already, and really looking forward to the rest of the ones he wrote. And actually, Gary Russell mentions on the On Target documentary that Ian Marta would have been the first in the queue to do a New Adventures for him had he still been with us. So alas, that never got to happen. But anyway, so I'm digressing again. Back to the book. Yes, a well-written, good fun romp. Interesting characters. Great fleshing out by Ian Marta. Just thoroughly really enjoyed it. I was thinking about an 8 for the novel, perhaps with the audiobook. Perhaps I'll push it up to a 9, perhaps a 9 out of 10 for this one from me. Al.
That's pretty good. Yeah, I think I totally agree with you on the book. It's so, so much better. The TV episodes, it just feels like it's actually a proper story now, because I always thought that the TV episodes were a bit put together at last minute, you know, we've got to have a story, what do we do sort of thing, where the book is much more detailed, it's bigger, it's expansive. So I think I would give the book, like you, an 8, and I love the audiobook. John Coleshaw is just fantastic reading it. Gets everything bang on, you're sort of engaged from the beginning. I would say that the only thing I would change is probably I might have edited chapters, but that's just a niggle. So I think a 9.
A 9 as well. Another high score, Al. We're enjoying these at the moment, aren't we?
We are indeed. They've all been very good at the moment.
Next time on the Target Files.
The Edge of Destruction. Book by Nigel Robinson and audiobook read by William Russell.
Doctor Who Target Files featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. I Am the Doctor, composed by Murray Gold. Version for this podcast by Grueling Terror 42. Check out their channel on YouTube. Newsround opening and closing themes by John Baker. And by Ted Heath and his orchestra. No copyright infringement intended. Incidental music for the Sontaran experiment, composed by Dudley Simpson. And for the 5 Doctors, composed by Peter Howell. No copyright infringement intended. The Sontaran experiment review
was recorded in Swansea, South Wales and Exeter, Devon, UK during July 2016.